Welcome to day 17 of the Altar in the Valley experience. You've made it all the way through the bottom of the canyon, crossed the Colorado River, and now it's time to ascend the south rim to the finish line. From here on out, we experience steep inclines and temperatures well above 100 degrees. As we look ahead to this next leg, let me take you back to an even more intense journey through the canyon. It's 1869, and the canyon is almost completely unexplored. The trails and bridges that paved the way for us on our hike won't be constructed for decades. The canyon is one of the last places in the U.S. to be mapped. Almost everything is unknown. But this didn't stop a man by the name of John Wesley Powell, a veteran of the Union Army in the Civil War with just one arm from a wartime amputation, and an adventurous scientific explorer. John Wesley Powell set off with four wooden boats and nine men from the southwest region of the Wyoming Territory to travel the Green River to the Colorado River and all the way through the Grand Canyon, a total of 277 miles. This is the first recorded time anyone had taken this journey, and he was determined to be the first to make a detailed map of the area for the generations to come. John Wesley Powell knew the journey would be difficult. In one of his famous quotes about the journey, he says, "We have an unknown distance yet to run, an unknown river to explore. What falls there are, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. What walls ride over the river, we know not."
I can't even imagine the fear and uncertainty he and his men must have been feeling as they set off, not knowing anything about the journey ahead without any of the technology we have today. Well, to say they faced some challenges on the way would be a huge understatement. Along the way, John Wesley Powell's group wrecked a boat with a month's worth of supplies and food. A total of four of his men abandoned him along the way. They faced treacherous whitewater rapids, severe weather, and dangerous climbs as they slowly mapped and made their way through their planned route. It took him and his crew over 3 months to complete the expedition, and many thought they had died because of the length of time they were gone. But the mission proved to be monumental in exploration and mapping of the Grand Canyon. Our journey through the Grand Canyon would not have been possible if it weren't for people like John Wesley Powell paving the way. And before we begin our ascent out of the canyon, I want to read another quote from him about the beauty of experiencing the canyon in such an intense way. He said, "You cannot see the Grand Canyon in one view, as if it were a changeless spectacle from which a curtain might be lifted. But to see it, you have to toil from month to month through its labyrinths."
After doing the hike from rim to rim of the canyon and experiencing it up close and personal, there's a great appreciation for the grandeur and magnificence. Of course, the view from the touristy areas on the rims are incredible, but you have such a greater appreciation for those views when you've seen the river up close, you've toiled through the heat, and you've stood before the massive cliffs and rock faces. And here's what I want us to focus on today. The journey is tough. The valley is hard, lonely, tiring, discouraging. But there's a beauty that can only be discovered walking through the valley. I believe, and I've experienced firsthand, how there's just something different about the way we find God and discover who He is in the valley. It's one thing to have a sideline tourist view of Him, just taking the word of others about who He is, and a whole different thing to discover who He is for yourself. And if we're willing to lean in during this time, I believe He will reveal Himself to you in powerful and incredible ways that you might easily miss if you had just lived on the mountaintop. The depths of the valley build depths of the soul. The next time you face a challenge where you need to trust God as your provider, your healer, your redeemer, your friend, your father, instead of just having a vague understanding like a tourist view of the Grand Canyon, you will remember Him from your up-close, personal encounters in the valley. I know your valley may feel deep, I know it may feel dark, and it's totally okay to pray for God's deliverance and healing in the midst of it. But He promises that when we seek Him, we find Him. So instead of only praying for God to lift you out, I encourage you to also pray that He would reveal more of Himself to you, that He would deepen your faith and dependence on Him, that you would know more of Him and become more like Him.
Jesus, Jesus, how I trust Him, how I've proved Him more and more. Jesus, Jesus, precious Jesus, all for grace to trust Him. Thank you.
guest for today is Dr. Jerry Root. Jerry is Professor Emeritus at Wheaton College, as well as a visiting professor at Biola University, Talbot Graduate School of Theology, and Moody Bible Institute, teaching C.S. Lewis courses at all three schools. For over 41 years, Dr. Root has lectured on C.S. Lewis topics at 78 universities in 18 countries. He is the author of numerous C.S. Lewis-focused books, articles, and publications. He is married to Claudia Root, and together they have four married children and 15 grandchildren.
Oftentimes there are people who struggle with disappointment, and they can't help but thinking that their expectations were not fulfilled, and they begin to wonder if maybe life has lost its sense of meaning and direction. As I think about these things, I often think that there is a contrast between religious belief and Christianity particularly. Now, C.S. Lewis, when he wrote Mere Christianity, said, "All religions have more in common with each other than any of them have with materialism, because all the religions believe in some sort of supernatural transcendence and whatnot." But there are places where Christianity is unique. Rudolf Otto, the man who wrote The Idea of the Holy, he said he saw three things in his years of studying religions where all the religions have in common. They all believe in some divine essence. Second, they all believe in a moral law that people fail to keep. And third, they believe the divine essence is a custodian of the moral law. So if I fail to keep the moral law, I've offended the divine essence. Christianity is unique among the world religions because all the other world religions, to fix a problem, come up with new kinds of rituals. And those rituals set expectation that maybe by virtue of my own merit, I could somehow placate the God and have him be pleased with me. But most people, because it's by virtue of their own efforts they're trying to do these things, end up feeling like they're insecure. How do they know they've done enough? Their expectations may be soaring, but they come into crashing disappointments. I think an easy way to contrast these would be to look at something like Buddhism versus Christianity. Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, was a prince, and he went out among his people and he saw that they were suffering. His assessment as to why they were suffering is because they had these unfulfilled expectations. His solution, eliminate your expectations. Get to the place where you can completely suppress them. Now, there are many kinds of Buddhists, but generally all of them have this at the core. If I can get rid of expectations, I will get rid of disappointment, and so on. Well, Christianity is very different than that. Christianity believes that you can have expectations. You're an embodied soul. You have physical needs and so on. That's okay to have those. But if you have them at the expense of Christ being first in your life, you will also set yourself up for disappointment. Augustine wrote about this. He called it ordo amoris, ordered loves. You put first things first, you get second things thrown in. You put second things first, you're destined to lose out on both first and second things, and again, have crashing disappointments. When we look at certain scriptures, we can see how this is played out, particularly. You have Psalm 16:11, "Thou wilt make known to me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore." If I try to make the right-handed pleasures the fulfilling absolute pleasures, I will be disappointed because they were never meant to be replacements for God. But if I put God first, then I can enjoy these things for what they can give and not expect from them what they can't give. You have something similar in James 1:17. "Every perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or shifting shadow." The shifting shadow things are those things Jesus warned about where he says moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. Again, the things that moth and rust may attack and whatnot, those are not necessarily bad things. They're just not eternal things. They can't fulfill you eternally. Only one can, and that's the one who made you for himself. There was one biblical author who called the poetic books of the Bible the how-to books. You've got Job, how to suffer. Psalms, how to worship in good times and bad. Proverbs, how to be wise. Song of Solomon, how to love. But what about Ecclesiastes? It's almost like how to be confused about life or something, it seems, at the surface. But in reality, Ecclesiastes is how to enjoy life. How to have right expectations so that you can enjoy life to the full. And it begins, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, under the sun. The phrase under the sun is the operative term. You'll never enjoy life to the full with the mere under the sun perspective. And the reason why is because Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, God has placed eternity in our hearts. And in some senses, if eternity's in our heart, the temporal things can't satisfy us. We have to reorient ourselves so we put first things first again and get second things thrown in. The key verse of the book of Ecclesiastes is Ecclesiastes 2:25. For who can eat and who can enjoy life without him? You give me him and I can enjoy all these other things. You remove him and none of these other things can ever satisfy. What the Buddhists were trying to do was eliminate anything that would awaken desire for that particular thing. Just suppress it, get rid of it. Christians would say, no, desire rightly. Ordo amoris. Cultivate love for God first and foremost. And as you do that, you can then enjoy life as an embodied soul. Christians center on the incarnate Christ who took on flesh and came in our world and showed us how to live this embodied life. Again, not putting these things in our world first, but enjoying them as second things with great gratitude and praise towards the God who is always self-offering that we might find our ultimate fulfillment in him. So this idea of making sure we're thinking through how to have proper expectations as embodied souls in this world, and also how to work in such a way whereby we see how the balance works. And it works when you keep Jesus at the center.
I'm caught up in your presence. I just want to sit here at your feet. I'm caught up in this holy moment. I never want to leave. Oh, I'm not here for blessings, 'cause Jesus, you don't owe me anything more than anything that you could do. I just want you. And I'm sorry when I've come with my agenda. I'm sorry when I forgot that you're enough. Take me back to where we started. I open up my heart to you, Jesus. And I'm sorry when I've come with my agenda. I'm sorry when I forgot that you're enough. Take me back to where we started. I open up my heart to you. I'm caught up in your presence. I just want to sit here at your feet. I'm caught up in this holy moment. just want you and nothing else. And nothing else. Nothing else will do. I just want you and nothing else. And nothing else. Nothing else will do. I just want you and nothing else, and nothing else, nothing else will do. I just want you and nothing else, nothing else, nothing else will do. We just want you, we just need you, we really need you. We just want you, Jesus. Hey.
Jesus, we know that nothing else will do. We put our focus upon you. We want our attention to be on you. May our affections be fixed on you. God, I pray that you would help us to put you first in all things. In Jesus' name.